This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, I've gotten a lot of good feedback from this last week's episode, number 611, with Jack Brutus Penny and Sean Rivera regarding playing cards and the creation of cards and how to collect cards and just what is it about playing cards that fascinates magicians. Well, anyhow, a lot of good feedback that I had received from that, so apparently it resonated well with you listeners. I'm glad that you like that. It was something, again, I thought was educational as well. If you missed that one, then you need to go back and take a listen. It was a lot of fun. Two different guys that I spoke with independent from each other in different parts of the world at the time as well. And also, as to last week's episode, I know some of you have been going to YouTube and watching the videos and that supplement this audio podcast. And this past week, really, it was a perfect opportunity to view that because I brought in some photos of the cards that Jack Penny had developed and he had designed and kind of showed some of the original designs and also some of the pictures from his older cards he had a couple of years ago. So really, the video is a perfect kind of way of showing what it is that he's developing, plus getting kind of a peek at Sean Rivera's collection that he has at his home then as well that he showed during that conversation that we recorded and put on YouTube. So if you haven't had a chance to go back to YouTube, then go back and take a view of that. You can go to youtube.com/texasmagician and you can find that. Of course, if you subscribe to the pod letter that we send out each week, there is a link there that will show you that week's video. And also, if you go to the magicwordpodcast.com, there on the blog is a link to that video, as there are in the past several weeks that we've been doing these videos on YouTube, again, to supplement the audio. This week, we're going to be talking with comedy magician Bill Abbott. Bill is not only a comedy magician who has worked in comedy clubs, but also corporate events and has his own magic shop online, which is BillAbbottMagic.com. But beyond that, some of the things we talk about in the first part of this has to do with comedy clubs, which is kind of a thing of the past. And so from an historical standpoint, that's interesting. But the real gems that he's dropping in here along the way are tips on how to be entertaining to your audience and what it is they can take away from your performance. So if you're thinking about adding comedy to your show, or if you think you are a comedy magician, perhaps you might want to listen close and maybe take some notes as to what Bill has to suggest in here. There are a lot of really great ideas that, again, he discusses throughout this entire podcast. So from start to finish, there are some really good, great stuff. So I know you're going to enjoy it. So please welcome my guest here this week, Mr. Bill Abbott, here on The Magic Word. Today, my guest is Mr. Bill Abbott, and he has come to us actually from Canada, and he is a now citizen, I believe, who holds a green card. We'll talk about that. He's in the U.S. then now. A very funny guy, someone I have known for quite some time. He's worked some comedy clubs. I'd like to talk to him a little bit about that. Perhaps as we go about here today, we're also going to talk to him about being a corporate magician. He does a lot of the same or similar types of venues that I do, and I really enjoy working corporate parties and doing some cocktail parties and strolling as well as after dinner, and that kind of thing, plus some other small venues and things that he does. So let's welcome our guest. Please welcome Mr. Bill Abbott. Hey there, Bill.
Hey, Scott.
Glad to have you over here today. So you started out in Canada. I was going to ask you about working comedy clubs in Canada. Did you do that for a while in Canada?
I worked every kind of venue I could get my hands on.
Okay.
Comedy clubs were a lot of open mics. Obviously, were great places to try out material, hone material.
Sure.
Obviously, with a comedy bent, so that was something the comedy had to be in the forefront. So I learned very quickly that, you know, I couldn't bring massive props onto the stage and, you know, be a magician, quote unquote. I had to be funny first. So that taught me a lot in that venue anyways. And
well, how did comedy or clubs, well, I'm assuming they are not as big of a thing there as what they used to be, just like in the U.S., comedy clubs. I guess with the advent of the internet and television and other kinds of things and venues in Vegas and whatnot, seems like, again, the comedy club tour is not what it used to be. And so did you in Canada have that kind of a tour that you would go from one club to the next and kind of travel around Canada for a while? As you said, you were trying everything that you could, but I'm just kind of curious to know what the comedy club circuit was like back then. What year would that have been approximately?
Well, you're talking probably the 90s for me.
Okay.
So 90s, early 2000s. So it was, I didn't really do a tour because I was in Toronto and there was so many open mic opportunities that I was doing that. Eventually I, you know, got paid, quote unquote,
yeah.
But it was more, more just to get stage time, flight time to, mm-hmm. for myself, for material. And then, you know, I was predominantly a close-up magician doing walk around at parties. I used to walk around at nightclubs, all through college. And that was really kind of what I was focused on. And then I realized I really wanted to create a stand-up show. And really the only way to work that out was at either comedy clubs, and sometimes it would be like a coffee shop that would have an open mic, or that would be, so I didn't really travel too far. I mean, I would travel in and around the Toronto area. But back then there seemed to be, you know, the Yuck Yucks chain was pretty solid and massive back then with Mark Breslin. And then there was a lot of fledgling smaller comedy clubs. And like I said, coffee houses and stuff like that, that were doing open mics. Just honestly, I would just get my name on the list, walk in, do my set, and just continually try to record what I could, usually just audio record it, and just try to get better all the effects that I was working on.
There's a popular television series you may have seen, The Marvelous Miss Maisel.
I love it.
Yeah, great show. And as I recall in watching that, seems like she was putting her name on the list and it would be further on down. Then as she got more popular, they'd move her on up. And is that the case? I mean, in reality, as far as going in and just signing up and they decide where they're going to put you, depending upon your popularity of being here last time, that, hey, he was pretty good last time, let's move him up, or you know, she was paying off the manager with a casserole or something. I mean, so I just wondered if there was, how did you decide, or how was it decided where you and sure. would appear in the list?
I wasn't actively trying to get up the list, so my lack of interest in that regard probably rubbed off on the management, whoever, you know, the talent, you know, the booker that was there. I, you know, once you start doing it and you get some, you know, they see that, oh, he's decent, let's see. And then eventually after a couple of years, I actually got some offers to do a feature. So I would start doing features. I did headline a couple of years for a couple months, but it was never my goal to create a comedy act. I was always wanting to do magic. And the funny thing was at the comedy club, and part of the reason, you know, the magic was sort of frowned upon, was because if you're funny and you do magic, you are the standout of the evening. I mean, it's like a juggler at a magic convention. They're going to be the standout. And I think what happened, you know, I do, and I still have a lot of comics who are friends, but it was a harder road to toe. And I really, my objective was really not to become a comedian. It was to do magic. And this was a venue that was, you know, that had an audience and an opportunity for me to do it. I did have to create, you know, I had a solid 10 to 15 minutes of jokes and without magic, which I think is super important if you're going to go into that field, obviously, if that's the objective.
Right.
But my objective, for all intents and purposes, was to get flight time for the magic I wanted to do. And that was it. I mean, I came from doing kids parties, and I was be doing 6 or 7 or 8 kids parties on a weekend previous to doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. I loved the, you know, throw it in the case, go and do the shows, throw it, drive to the next gig. And that momentum and the energy and just the building process of building routines and building a repertoire, basically, of solid effects that you can literally do anywhere in front of anyone. And you know, the comedy club seemed to be the next succession. I mean, the comedy clubs are, they, you know, the audiences weren't any harder. I mean, the kids,
well, they're just, they're just grown up kids, basically. You're still doing a kids show.
Right.
And treating them like children sometimes after they start drinking a lot.
Drunk kids, yeah, exactly.
Just drunk kids. Exactly. Exactly. I have heard some magicians talk about when, or in comedians, their goal was never, and still is, never to necessarily become the headliner, the one at the end who would do the longer piece, but they want to be a middle. You know, I guess there's, in most comedy clubs, there'll be someone who is the MC. There'll be a somebody new who will come on perhaps and do the first 10 minutes, and then there'll be somebody in the middle, do a little longer, and then finally the feature act. Isn't that basically the...
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I love doing, you know, 10-minute spots, maybe 15-minute spots. I mean, the feature was about 15, but yeah, 10-minute spots for me was an opportunity to at least work in one routine, one solid routine. I would say some jokes and work in a routine. You know, the only issue that I think the hard thing is that when you're in that environment, you kind of get roped into a very specific style. I mean, not that you can't be yourself, but, you know, the laughs per minute have to be up there. And sometimes with magic, and I'm learning now about sort of becoming or transitioning into becoming a real magician and doing real magic. And I think that's the real difference, is that you're when you're focused on the jokes, and I have been for years, even up to this moment. And now, you know, in retrospect and in hindsight and in moving forward and progressing as a, you know, performance artist, I guess, I really am focused on the magic end of things. And like, I mean, a joke can kill a great magic effect, you know, and I mean that in a negative way.
Yeah, you mean people will remember the joke more than they will the trick itself, basically. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like I would get, you know, even in the past few years, I would do one of the small theaters, one of the small magic theaters here in the States, and I would read reviews afterwards to see what people were taking away from it, and they would say, oh, you know, the food was great, you know, the dinner show, the food was great, and the comedian was hilarious. I realized, you know, I remember Jack Goldfinger saying, like, it's not called the Comedy Castle, Bill. It's not called the Improv Castle. It's not called the Mind Reading Castle. It's called the Magic Castle. And that always stuck with me, too, because I always thought, yeah, people are here to see magic. They're, you know, if they want to go to a comedy club, they'll go to a comedy club to see, you know, if they want to see comedy, I should say, they will go to a comedy club, but it's not called that.
Well, in LA, I think there is the Comedy and Magic Club, and in fact, the Magic Island here in Houston would advertise on the outside saying Comedy and Magic, the Magic Island, Comedy and Magic.
Yeah.
Whenever, they're not going to be reopening, long story, but the one here in Houston.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to be happening anytime soon, if at all. But anyhow, when they were going to be opening, and I was talking with the owner, and they had hired me to be the entertainment director, the first thing he asked was, do you know comedians? We'd like to have comedians to come in here. He didn't say comedy magicians. He didn't say magicians. He said, we'd like to have some comedians come in here. And I think he was meaning, in addition to magicians, we would like to have some comedians. And I was saying, yeah, I've got contacts who are just comedians, and also on the comedy circuit, I can talk with some people locally who run the improv, et cetera, and try and route them through here then as well. But they wanted to try to re-emphasize the comedy portion of the entertainment of being comedy and magic, having magicians doing close-up and strolling as well as on the stage, but mainly to make sure we have enough variety to bring in some comedians. And I was, of course, saying a lot of magicians do comedy magic, or magic itself is inherently funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we are surprised, we often react not with applause, but with laughter, because we're surprised, you know.
Yeah. Well, even in fear, we react in laughter. You know,
that's true too.
You laugh through a horror movie, you know, because it's it's frightening.
It's frightening. Yes. Yeah. You're not going to be necessarily screaming, be laughing. It's like, what was funny about that? I don't know what was funny. It just caused me to laugh. And, you know, that was another thing. And working with comedians, I know in the past I've heard some comedians say he's just a prop comic, and meaning a magician who just is doing something with some props, or if it wasn't for the gimmick that he's relying on, he wouldn't be funny. What is your take on that?
Well, my take is that the concept, and it's not entirely wrong, is that you can go to a magic shop and buy material, do the material in front of an audience, get a reaction, mostly favorable, and not put any work into, you know, your character, your personality, your jokes, you know, joke writing, you know, creating either an act or creating a persona. It's truly like a crutch in a way where you have the ability to, again, just purchase something and do it out of the box and walk into a room and do it. And, you know, myself, you know, I'm to blame as well, because, you know, the way that magic has been sold, you know, marketed forever since magic started was selling, was that, you know, become the life of the party, be a showman. You're not in show business. You know, the funny, I always say that, what's the second thing you buy after an invisible deck?
Business card.
Business cards. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
Your business, baby. You know?
That's right. I got the best trick in the world right here.
That's right.
And that's what I'm going to do. That's, I even heard a magic dealer once saying, I would never sell an invisible deck to a beginner who is the first time in, you know, looking, because they would never buy anything else. It's just the perfect trick, basically.
Yeah.
So true. For the invisible deck. Well, speaking of then writing things and trying to have them entertaining rather than just buying a trick of the day and going and putting it in your show that night, which, as you say, you can't, unfortunately. What are some tips or advice that you would have on scripting as far as trying to come up with ideas? I mean, certainly if you do have some venues, as you say, where you can get some flight time and you go out to find these venues of whether they're going to be at a comedy club or even at children's parties, you can pick up some lines there that will work, transition well for adults as well, I'm sure. But how do you go about scripting this? And do you have any ideas or tricks on that?
Sure. I mean, if you're starting from the beginning, Eugene Berger was a mentor of mine, and he always said, if you can start with a great opening line that you've created or that sets the premise, and a great closing line, and just have the ability to start in that thing. And remember those two things. Remember your opening line, remember your closing line, do the trick in between.
So the great opening line, of course, is, how's everybody doing tonight?
No, but unfortunately that is the, it's overused.
Yeah.
But I always remember, you know, like I have an opening line to my, toss out deck, and it is, do you know it's physically impossible to maintain a poker face during a high stakes game of poker? As human beings, we have micro expressions, we have tells that give away exactly the type of hand we have, and we can't help it. So that's the hook. That's the, you know, that's the premise.
It gets people interested.
It gets people interested. So now you're talking about gambling, you're talking about making money, you're talking about, card playing, card cheats, or whatever you're playing. You're thinking, they're thinking Las Vegas, they're thinking high stakes poker table, you know, in a darkly lit room. Their imagination is excited. So then when you're doing something, you know, as I guess I'll say simple as a tossed out deck as an example, it goes beyond what the props are saying. They have a mental image, and they're not. So again, an opening line or an opening, you know, that was more than one line, obviously, but the opening premise sets the stage for the interest level the audience will have. So it's like that hook that grabs them, and then the trick, I feel, holds them as long as you maintain, you know, you're not going to make that opening statement and then pull out the coloring book and say, look, the colors are different. You know, the coloring book, you're going to do something that's correlated. So you maybe do something with some dice, or you maybe, it doesn't matter. But the point is, if you stay true to your premise, have a great opening line that hooks the audience. Gambling's a great theme because everyone's interested in in the gambling theme. And I think some sort of closing line, sometimes it's just a visual, sometimes it's some, but something where, you know, there's an end to the premise. Now, when I do the routine I just mentioned, I'm looking at poker tells as opposed to reading minds. So I wanted to show a skill rather than, you know, an alien gift as opposed to, you know, so I wanted to show a skill, the skill of poker reading, and then I test the audience. So that's the other fun thing too, is that you're testing the audience out. So now the audience is involved integrally, because they are now a part of the process. They're part of the,
you've brought them in, brought and they feel in. Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's, any good magic trick does that. And sometimes it's not, you know, pick a card. Sometimes they're just watching, but it's that hook. And I think that's the, you know, so I think for me, finding a great premise, helps the scripting part of it kind of write itself. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So it's like,
sure.
If you find whatever your premise is, if it's teleportation and you're teleporting this signed dollar bill into a piece of fruit or whatever, it's like, it's teleportation. We're going to teleport. This bill is going to visibly teleport from this place to this place. Well, people are, you know, they, maybe they've seen, you know, if they're our age, they're remembering Star Trek, or they're remembering,
right, science,
know,
fiction, right.
Science fiction, or they're, you know, whatever the case is, but they have an instant, there's a hook involved that they have now a visual, or they have a mental place to go that keeps them interested.
Well, you're talking about routining also, a routine. But what about, and that's an excellent suggestion. Everything that you've just said there and shared also from Brother Eugene, but what about the overall arc from the beginning of the routine, let's say 45 minutes later or 90 minutes later, however long your show is going to be, right. Do you try to keep each of those pieces of the act, that is this routine followed by this routine, in some sort of a pattern that would build and plateau, or have a kind of a, I wouldn't say a valley, but maybe just so it's kind of flat, but still entertaining and interesting. How would you go about scripting an overall act? Do you try to bring in something at the end that will be a callback from something in the show, or do you do kind of one unrelated thing after another? I'm comparing that for an example. Yep. Let's say Doug Henning versus David Copperfield, both excellent in their own way. Doug Henning, it seemed, would do one unrelated effect after another. David Copperfield seemed to have little vignettes that would tell stories, yeah. And then have callbacks and things. Both are excellent, of course. It's just they're different styles. So I'm asking you about how you design your act if it has some sort of an arc.
Well, I try to build it from... I honestly, right now, in the past few years, I've really built it upon the building of the effect level and the impossibility level, and taking it from, you know, something that's I would say simple into something that is truly inexplicable, and that's really my only arc. I guess it's sort of unrelated, and even if you look at Copperfield's, you know, we're thinking obviously of his TV specials, but if you look at his current show in Vegas, there are some unrelated effects that are in,
right,
the beginning of the show. It's like he's doing an effect. Here's a trick. Here's something else. Impossible,
sure.
Impossible. And then the overall arc is that his relationship with his father, his grandfather, and then, you know, that's building to a finale.
Yeah.
Climax.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel... And that's really, without going into too much, you know, laborsome detail, but essentially what I'm trying to do is I start with something that maybe is explainable, and from it's a surprise, but it's like, it's fun. It's not going to make you change your religion, but then later on in the show, I'm going to show you some stuff that might change your religion. I think that's the build that I try to do. I mean, obviously, the thread is me, you know, the overall thread is just me in the show doing these effects, and really my interaction with the audience. I look at a show like a party, and this is how I truly see it. I feel like, okay, so imagine yourself, Scott, you've invited to a dinner party to someone in your neighborhood. You don't really know these people very well, but you go to this dinner party and you don't really know anyone. You're not there with anyone, but there's 8 or 10 people there. You sit down at the table and you have this amazing meal and you have some glasses of wine and you're really feeling good, but you've kind of run out of small talk,
mm-hmm.
You know,
that happens.
You're kind of like, and you're trying to Well, I guess maybe should I leave now? Maybe should I should. What's my exit strategy? What are my closing lines? And then all of a sudden, you hear some piano playing in the living room, and everyone gets up and walks from the dining room to the living room. And one of the guests is a pianist, and he starts playing. And you're like, he's really good, and you're really getting into it. And all of a sudden, he's playing some songs that you know, and then there's songs that everybody knows. All of a sudden, he's playing a Billy Joel song, and people start singing along.
Singing along, yeah.
Now you're having another drink, and now there's this collective effervescence that everyone is now joined by this moment. That's what I want to do in my shows.
I want to
take strangers and give us all, within a 45-minute period, we all now have inside jokes. We all have, there's some characters in the crowd that we've all had some fun with. If there was an overall arc or an overall, that's what I'm trying to do. My father is a professional musician, a pianist, and a composer, and I would see him do exactly those things at a party. He would start playing the piano, and all of a sudden, that whole room changed from a bunch of people who were talking about gas prices and politics and, you know, things,
sports that,
you know,
and whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just sort of mundane things that they would talk with anybody out, you know, anybody else, all of a sudden changing that group of people into a true, once in a lifetime memory, you know, and that's really what I, you know, that's my goal. Really. If there was a goal, or an overall, you know, experience I want to create, that's the experience.
And trying to bring people on that journey, starting with an introduction to you and really kind of to each other, so they have a shared experience, so that by the end they're talking about that experience and the journey they have come to the conclusion.
And I think comedy, you know, if you look at comedy, comedians for the most part, they're connecting with the audience,
right,
with a shared experience. Oh, don't you hate when you go to the airport and this happens?
Yeah, people can relate to that kind of a thing. Just like
relatable, yeah.
Just like you were talking about the tells or something, people can kind of relate to. Yeah. Everyone will have a different little mental picture, I guess, of something when you start to tell a story, because they are creating these things in their mind, which is different from the person sitting next to them, but they're still similar in some ways. And at the end, they kind of feel like they have participated with that. Even though they're not on stage, they're participating from the audience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I know you create a lot of things as well, certainly, and have BillAbbottMagic.com, where you've got a lot of really great stuff that's available that you do as well. And some of these things I know are not all your ideas, I guess, or I mean, like Chris Pillsworth and some other people who have contributed and have some great ideas that that you market for them. But when it comes down to the presentation, do you spend about an equal amount of time working on these commercially and going out and then coming back and saying, this is a commercial trick, this is something that's in my act that I do, and I've worked out some lines, and do you?
Yeah, so I came by it kind of by accident, in terms of I didn't wake up, you know, as a 12-year-old boy wanting to be a magic dealer. But what happened was my local magic club, I had been doing magic professionally for probably 6 or 7 years, and the local magic club asked if I would come and do a lecture. My friend Jeff Pinsky at the Browser's Den of Magic. And I said, sure, but I'm not going to fool any magicians with any material I'm doing. I'm really just doing, I would say, some standard stuff, but with my own presentations and my own approach to it. And he said, no, that's what I want you to do. I want you to do the stuff I want you to share the stuff you actually do, because, and I said, well, that's really all I know. I'm not a finger flinger. I'm not I would never attempt to fool magicians, or even magician friends. So, it was successful. It was successful for me, but also empowered me, I think, in a lot of ways to have this feeling that this information that I had gleaned through experience was worth something. And I think that's where that started. And then fast forward a couple of years, you know, I had two kids, and in between shows, I would be looking for more work, but then also realizing that there was more opportunities to lecture. Mm-hmm. So, you know the lecture field, you know, better than I do. So you know that if you're not selling something, you're not really making any money. So I realized that, I need to get some product together. So that's when I started putting some props together. But the main objective or the main philosophy behind Bill Abbott Magic and what I had started way back then was like, I only wanted to share material that I'd actually done. I only wanted to share material that had actually been worked in front of paying audiences.
Not just pipe dreams, but actual things you have worked on.
Not brain parts or anything, just actual stuff that I actually done, they actually performed for real humans. And that was always always the objective and still always is. And you mentioned that we have produced, several great artists who, like you mentioned, Chris Pillsworth, Peter Samuelson, John Archer, Lou, oh my gosh.
Sorrento?
Lou Leventhal,
yeah.
Anyways, and I've also worked with Richard Sanders. And so, again, all that material is stuff that they have been doing for years. I mean, you've probably seen Peter Samuelson do his gypsy thread routine, which is sort of iconic. And that type of material, and that's when they either approached me or I approached them, because I was like, if you ever want to, showcase this, because, I know most of these guys were doing and still do lecture tours of some sort, or they were, they wanted to get put their stamp on this routine, make sure that, this was known as theirs. And so that was really the whole thrust. And, we've had, great success in all those areas, and partnering with people has been a big part of that as well.
Well, when you were saying you also use ideas of people who you have seen perform, and sometimes I guess they come to you with an idea because you're a noted dealer of these kinds of things, I guess, most of which are more stand-up type of performance pieces.
We do have some close-up, but the predominant, the predominant material is for stand-up, stand-up magic, stand-up shows, larger crowds. Yeah.
So people tell you also about other ideas, saying, I saw this guy or gal do something, you might want to contact them and see if they want to release something, I assume, from time to time. Or do people just out of the blue send you ideas?
Yeah, so like one interesting one is Steve Hamilton, who's a magician from Canada. He was doing, someone sent me a video of him at the Magic Castle doing this really hilarious, he was doing one of my tricks, was the five card box of the five card opener, which is basically a five card repeat into a box, except, and he was retelling how it was the very first trick he ever did. But in addition to doing the trick, he also had three costume changes. So he would start with a tuxedo, and then all of a sudden he peels that off, and underneath that is like short pants, but the bow tie was still there. And then at the end,
right,
the little baby sleeper, the very last trick, the very last time, the last phase. So after someone sent me that video, and I was like, I got to get a hold of this guy. This is hilarious and fantastic. I don't know if he has an interest in marketing it, but I thought he really needs to. I really felt like this is something I wanted to do, and I wondered if he had any interest in marketing it. That was
so. Really, everything that you see like that is something you would see yourself doing. Then, hey, I 100%. Like that. I'd like to do that myself, and I can also, maybe we can all make some money off of this.
That's the filter. The filter for me is like, ooh, that looks great. That's something that I
want to do. I could see myself doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love, Chris Pillsworth, you mentioned, his paper bag, egg bag. Fantastic.
Oh, awesome.
Amazing. And if you look at the engineering of it and the way it's designed, it's simply fantastic.
I bought two of them. I want to just say commercially, right. Wonderful. I've been doing egg bag for years. Yeah. I love Jeff Hobson's. I've got two of Hobson's bags. I always have a backup for those things you like the best. I always recommend that you have a backup. And this is one of those things, because it is a paper bag, as you had said in the video, you can use it 100 or more times, but still it's best to have a good backup. And this is just a beautiful routine. And Chris is a very clever fellow.
Very clever. Yeah. He's consulted for a lot of big name, Vegas acts, and he's such a sweetheart of a guy.
Well, his cactus and balloon, of course, is what some people might have seen before, and that was what he is known for as being his thing. And I think he has only shared that with two people, one of them Rick Wilcox, and I think it was somebody in China, perhaps.
Right.
So that's really kind of a super secret thing that he does. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Seen him do that at the 4F convention a couple of times, and wow, it's a fooler.
It's a fooler. It's iconic too. It's such a bizarre image.
Well, there again, see the concept of that. People can realize of the mystery. Basically, you have a cactus and you have a blown up full balloon and they're in boxes and you kind of push the box down and all of a sudden the two boxes are one. And when he takes the box off, then now the cactus is inside the balloon and has not popped. And it is a regular balloon. You can pop it. I mean, whatever. But the point is that is a mystery and people can relate to that and talk about it and explain it just in one sentence. It's one of those things I believe Vernon or whomever had said in the past about how that you should be able to explain the trick in one sentence as opposed to he counted down the number of cards and then I cut it and then I shuffled, you know, whatever you want to say, my card was on the ceiling, you know, or that cactus was in a balloon. You know, that's just one of those types of tricks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really mind blowing. And it's a bizarre image that you can't erase it from your mind. That way, I think that's part, you know, it's like, I mean, we have obviously had a deluge of, you know, watching performers do the Bill and Lemon or whatever,
right?
You know, but as a layperson, you can only imagine the strangeness of, you know, they checked out a lemon, they're cutting it open, and inside is money. What a bizarre, I mean, and that's why that effect is so iconically memorable, is because it's such a bizarre image. It's like cutting, I'm sure the very first cutting a woman in half effect would have been the most weirdest thing you've ever seen, you know, it's just because that image is so iconically bizarre,
right,
that you can't get out of your head.
I guess one of the early ones, which we still, unfortunately, still use, of course, is a rabbit in a top hat. It's like, well, how did a rabbit get in this gentleman's top hat, kind of a thing? And so it's, again, something that could be explained then very easily. Those are the kinds of things, again, that are just kind of iconic. I wanted to kind of shift things just a little bit and talking a little bit further about doing corporate work. Mm-hmm. A lot of magicians I know have gone from doing corporate work, magic, I should say, being an after dinner performer to being an after dinner speaker, because you have to carry fewer props and it oftentimes pays better. And so they go from magician to speaker, where they might still use a trick or two in explaining something that's a concept or whatever is their subject for speaking. I know you do both as well. And so how did you make that transition? And what was the epiphany that you came to of deciding that's what I want to do?
I don't know if I've actually, I've never,
you really haven't converted completely over to that
speaking. No, because I just love magic too much. And I think part of the appeal of the speaking engagement, other than the fact that you don't bring any props and you're not, is that some magicians, I'm just obviously stereotypically, but I'm maybe making a generalization, but I know for myself, there was that moment where I was like, I can actually share something, what feels more real than a magic trick that people are going to take away and could potentially better their lives, better them, better the world around us, et cetera. I never got full blown into the speaking. I mean, I did work for some speaking agencies where they would book me and I would, you know, attempt to get the speaking fees that they were getting. But more importantly, what I also realized early on that I really think magic is a gift and it has the same impact, can have the same impact, and can, you know, empower people and do, you know, and do all those things that speaking things do just differently. And now that I'm comfortable in my role as a magician, I think, you know, there was moments where I was like, man, you know, I went full mentalism at one point and then I kind of swung back and now I'm kind of in the middle again, doing a, you know, mentalism and magic mix.
Did you do some comedy mentalism or was it supposed to be?
There was always comedy in it. But I did do straight mentalism, trying to cut out as many jokes as I could. So it was just the impact of the effect. And like, I can see the appeal of that when you start doing magic and then you go to mentalism, you're getting, you know, just the crazy reactions where people are, you know, mind blowing. It's like, and you realize, some of the techniques are very the same, if not similar to what I was already doing in magic, except, you know, in many ways, sometimes easier or sometimes, you know, minus the sleight of hand, et cetera. So there is that, you know, that power thing too, where you're all of a sudden like, oh, look at that. I just, you know, I've got a tossed out deck and now they think I'm, you know, walking on water. And I think the speaking engagement type of thing, if you have a strong message and you have a message that you feel you want to bring to the world or people in general, I think that's really important to do that. But my message is that with love, I want to make strangers friends. I want to create mm-hmm. memories in moments, and whether it's an engagement or whether it's a ticketed, theater show, that's to create an incredible memory. Have a reason to celebrate life. Have a reason to celebrate an occasion.
So, do you want people at the end of your show to remember Bill Abbott, or do you want them to remember there was this wonderful magician who did such and such a trick, or it's just that, or the memory that I had a wonderful evening one time with a group of friends?
I think as I've aged, I think I've recognized my ego, and I'm still dealing with it. But mm-hmm.
We all do.
So, and you have to have an ego to get on stage. You have to have an ego to be in front of an audience and imagine that you have anything valuable to give them or to show them.
Well, you have to have an ego, first of all, even to get booked, because when people call you, you right. want that to be the last call. And so right. you have to think right. enough of yourself to say, yeah, you don't need to call anybody else. I'm the person right. you need. This should be your first and last call. Or if you already made three or four others, you don't need to make yeah. another one. You've just got the right guy. Likewise, whenever you're doing a cocktail party or a restaurant and you're walking up to a group, you've got to think that what you have to say and to show them is more important than whatever they're talking about. That some business deal or someone saying, I've just had a bad experience with this or got this diagnosis back from the doctor. It's like, well, I'm here to let you have fun. And you got to have that big ego,
Sure. I think an ego unchecked is not a good thing, but getting back to the original question or answer to the question is that without an ego, it's impossible to do what we do.
Right.
So my ego says, yes, of course I want them to remember Bill Abbott. I want them to remember Bill Abbott over, the rubber chicken they just had at the banquet. I want right. them to remember, and if there's another performer, I want to try to do my best so they remember me at the end of the evening. I've gotten away from that because I feel that gets in the way. For me, it gets in the way of really doing a great show for the reason, like I mentioned, expressing through love and excitement, the art of magic in a way that it brings the audience together. And that's really because if it's all about the performer, I feel, yes, they're brought together, but there's an emptiness afterwards. There's a feeling of like, yeah, that guy was good. But there wasn't a feeling of like, we just laughed our heads off and we had a great time. And I don't know how the tricks were done, but more importantly, my wife and I were celebrating our anniversary and we had the best night ever, Cause yeah. at the end of the day, it's like, 10 years in the future, they're going to remember the evening and the way that they felt. They probably won't remember Bill Abbott. And I'm cool with that. I'm happy with that. Cause I know I just love performing. I just want to get in front of people and do my tricks and have a good time myself. That became my social life years ago. So for me, I just want to do that. When any opportunity where someone's going to pay me to do that, I'm there.
Right.
Honestly.
Well, that's the real secret I think magicians don't want to share with the lay public, and that is we would do this for free. Because we love it so much. And just give us that opportunity to hear some laughter and applause.
I'm going to interrupt you because that's exactly it's a problem when all of a sudden you have two young kids and you've made magic your vocation, you've made magic your career. So when you're saying, I want them to remember Bill Abbott because I need you to book me next year. I need you.
Right.
I need to, every show is a big commercial for everybody in that room.
Right.
To see what they're actually going to experience exactly what I do. I don't have to cold call you. I don't have to explain that. Then I do this and then the lady floats and then no. You're actually going to see what I do. You're going to feel what I do.
Right.
And you're going to feel hopefully feel the value. You're going to feel, the feelings I want you to feel so that I know you've had a positive experience. And I think you know, there's two equations. Do we want to remember Bill Abbott because, you know, Bill Abbott has an ego that he needs fed? Or I think more importantly, over the years, what I've realized is I want to remember Bill Abbott so that they hire me and so I can continue to do what I do and support my family. And I think that's, those are obviously two equations, but for both reasons, yes, I want to remember Bill Abbott. That was a long answer to that question, but.
Of course. Well, I was just thinking also about cruise ship magicians, particularly when I talk with people who have just returned from a cruise ship, and they will come to me and say, oh, we had saw a magician. We know you're a magician, Scott, and with, I don't know if you know this guy or not. And I said, well, who was it? And they're like, well, he did this trick with these rings, and they kind of came together. And we can be more specific, because sometimes they will mention a trick which a person is known for, and I'll say, oh, was it so-and-so? That was who it was, because I know who's working out there. Right. But my point is 99.9% of the people don't remember the names of the magician on a cruise ship. Yeah. But I think they want the people to remember the feeling they had. So when they're filling out the comments card about the magicians, like that guy was great or that gal, whatever, they're trying to make sure they have a good experience. So they're able to get booked again. They don't necessarily care about their name being known to the general public because they're not going to get booked to go work at somebody's party once they get off the ship necessarily. Yeah. Right. But they want to be able to be booked on that cruise for a longer period of time and for the group to know them. So again, they're not trying to, it's not all about them and their name so much as it is about the mystery and the fun and everything that they have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unless you're on TV, unless you're
right.
You're becoming a household name through the media, through and you know, there's you know people YouTube.
Well, it's the thing like Michael Carbonaro, for an example, yeah. Who's got a name and he does then theater shows as well. I mean, he's not going to be coming necessarily and performing like a Jimmy's birthday party book. However, there are larger corporations who are going to say, I saw you on TV or I saw your theatrical show, just like Matt King or whomever in Vegas. They get booked to do things outside of the city that I'm sure are very well paying, or else they wouldn't go and do it. And likewise, if you have a name, I mean, people are coming to see Michael Carbonaro show, or they're coming to see Matt King, but they're not coming to see Scott Wells, and they're not going to. And that's the thing. I think if you have a celebrity name, if you will, in the community, people know you, you know, Chris Angel and, or whomever, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think that's a different level, obviously, that we're not, you know,
involved. David Blaine or whatever, right?
David Blaine. Yeah. and I think that's, so going back to what you said, I think that's the thing is like, you're not, yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, I'm sure people go on a Disney cruise and see David Williamson and like, he's the funniest thing they've ever experienced.
Right.
I'm sure there's people that are like, who was the guy's name? Oh, Magic Dave. That's what we remember. Dave. So, but at the same time, it's like, unless you're, you know, unless it's some a name that you've heard, you know, I can't remember what the marketing thing is, but you have to hear something five times before it even registers in your brain, you know, so you have to hear it. You know, I'm talking old school, but I heard it on the radio. Then I saw the TV commercial and then I saw it on a Facebook ad. Then I saw, you know, so like you need to see all these three things or four or five things before your brain actually registers like, oh, this is something I need to pay attention to.
That's true, because there are tens of thousands of messages we get throughout the day, whether on billboards, television, radio, when you're driving in the radio, whatever. And unless you start to hear this a couple of times, or let's say you're driving in a car and you hear a car commercial and then you see a car drive by. And then that evening you see a television commercial about that car or truck or whatever. It finally starts to click. But you're exactly right. I think you have to have that multiple kinds of advertising, which is important, I believe, particularly to gig performers as magicians, to be everywhere you can. I'm thinking, for an example, of Murray Sawchuk. That guy is every place. I mean, he has over 2 million YouTube subscribers, and he is taking jobs wherever. It doesn't matter. It, as long as they spell his name correctly, he's kind of taken on that position like Houdini or whomever he used to do, and it's kind of like, yep, book me wherever. Reminds me of Uri Geller, for an example. Uri Geller used to, I think his original idea was to take all these photos with all these celebrities so people would say, who is that with Madonna, until eventually they'd say, who is that with Uri Geller, kind of a thing, you know. You just got to keep putting your name out there.
So here's a little thing I used to do, and I actually shared this with so the five card opener that that we talked about, the 5-card repeat,
which is brilliant, by the way.
Thanks. So, I won't get into the methodology because that's not what's important here. So what was important to me though, was there was a callback. So within the first 30 seconds, the audience was verbally and physically involved with the magic show. That's why it was an opener, because it was an opportunity to get the whole audience doing something. You know, so I had this thing where they would pump their fist in the air and say, and everyone says amazing. So that callback is in, that's repeated 3 or 4 times during that effect. And now that callback can be continued throughout the show. So at the end of any of the effect, the through line is that as soon as I put my fist in there, everyone will yell at the word amazing. So it's like this call and response type of thing. Now, something that I've shared and I actually have done in shows, what back when I was doing kid shows, is I would say, so it's Scott. So your name is Scott. So at the end of this trick, everyone pumped their fist and say, that's amazing, Scott. Now they're saying your name probably 12 times during the show because they're saying amazing, Scott. And I know a lot of performers, have used that, you know, throughout their show. Tim Hennig in
Chicago
just wrote that really great book on performing. I can't remember the name.
Anyway, there's a lot of children shows, a lot of high school.
Great. And I saw his grade school kids shows. Fantastic. Yeah. And if you look at his marketing, it's Tim, that's amazing. Panic, I think it's called. Tim, that's amazing. That's amazing. But that's his tagline. And I don't think I'm giving anything away for him, but he got that from doing the 5-card box, and that was the 5-card opener, and that was his callbacks that kept going and became his tagline, became his corporate tagline, and it's going to say corporate, but his company tagline. And but that's the thing. It's like having that hook so that you have a memorable thing that the audience can take home. They're like, oh, it's Tim, that's amazing. So when I Googled Tim, that's amazing, he comes up because he's, you know, Tim, that's amazing, Hennig or magician. So
that's a good idea to actually promote yourself using that kind of a tagline that people will remember.
Yeah.
One of the things I do is say load a bowl and I say magic water from Zanzibar. And about the third time that I do, and it's a running thing all the way through my show from start to finish. And about the third time that I do that, the audience will respond. I'll say magic water from, and they'll all say Zanzibar in unison. And that has gotten to be such a tagline for me. I have run into strangers in elevators and shopping malls, I mean, on several occasions. They'll look at me and say, magic water from Zanzibar? You won't remember Scott Wells, but it's like, Zanzibar?
You need to change your name to Zanzibar.
So do you do some strolling magic in addition to your after-dinner shows?
I haven't done that in a long time. Now, that being said, I still do walk around magic, or I guess strolling magic is best.
Yeah, cocktail type strolling.
Let's call it pocket magic because that's the best way to put it. So before a show and after a show, I always throw tricks in my pockets to do. Do I do them all the time? Not all the time. I'm rarely paid to do it. I just love to perform, and I love to give people a magic moment anywhere I can. So if I, you know, if before a show, I have the opportunity to wander in the crowd and do some magic, I will do that. And, you know, and
as a little extra thing, it's not something you've been paid to do, but you kind of got there early and you think, hey, why don't I go and entertain some people?
Well, I got a really lucrative contract several years ago with a group of insurance companies. Insurance companies, I can tell you from going to these insurance retreats, they would do a weekend retreat at some big resort, and they would have, you know, the sales this year compared to last year compared to the year before, and their sales are like this. They continually, you know, and maybe there's a curve up slightly, but they just continue to make money, but
mostly flat. It's continued,
you know, so they had a lot of money, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And what I realized though is that they would hire me for 45 minutes, my 45-minute show. They would fly me in. I'd get there. I'd be there for two to three days, do my show once, pack up, get back on the plane, and fly back. Now, what I realized, though, and the success that I had with doing those shows was I had a solid 45 minutes. But that's not why they continue to hire me. They continue to hire me because at the end of the night, when everyone was gathered in the hotel lobby bar, Bill Abbott was there doing magic, you know, or I wouldn't come out and just start doing magic. I would just hang out. And then inevitably the subject would come up because they just seen me on stage doing my show. And I would sit in the bar for, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 hours doing magic for all the attendees at the convention. And I feel like that's, and you know, those are the memories I know that they took home. I mean, the stage show is great, but it's the memory of the guy. And the guy was in the bar showing us magic all night. It was fantastic, you know. And I,
right.
And we know the impact of close-up magic is much different than stage magic. It's intimate. It's impactful. It
really and if it's affects, improvisational like that, in which you're at a bar and they just kind of say, hey, you know, you do some magic, you mind doing something? And it's just organic, if you will, that it just happens. And that's the thing is more memorable. It's just like producing a ham sandwich versus someone saying, I'm hungry. And then you give them a sandwich kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So this is something in which they are asking to see as opposed to.
Well, have you ever met a human being who's not a magician? I will preface that. I'm not a magician. Who didn't want to see a magic trick. Even the person who hates magic wants to see a magic trick to figure out how it's done.
That's true.
So people, you know what that's what they're thinking. So when you say, hi, I'm Scott Wells, what do you do? Oh, I'm a magician. And I know what you're thinking. Can you show me a magic trick? Because that's what they're thinking. You don't have to worry about it. And I feel like, you know, any opportunity... I got into magic because I love performing magic and I love the impact it has. I love the reactions that people get from it. And I know the memory, the little memory that's created sometimes. So I feel like I did struggle when I was first made, when I first made magic a career, I did struggle with, well, really people should really pay me for what I do and people should pay you for what you do.
Of course.
But we have this tremendous opportunity to advertise what we do. Any given moment of the day, we know enough magic, Scott, to sink a ship, I'm sure. We just need to throw some stuff in our pockets or in our wallets or whatever and be ready to do it. But more importantly, be willing to do it. And this is a big thing with magicians, like, well, unless I'm getting paid, I am not going to show you any magic. And I this whole gatekeeping concept of like tricks and magic and that, or the concept of that, you have something to share, just share it. And I think there's a bit of a hurdle, you know, as someone who's made his living by magic for the past 21 years now, there is a bit of a hurdle, a mindset that has to change. It had to change in me because I did have a bit of that feeling of like, well, unless you're paying me, I'm not going to perform. But it doesn't mean you have to do your 45-minute show for free. You can have magic to do and give people the experience of magic.
Well, there's a fine line, I think, also, Bill, in which you don't want to be a performing monkey, in which they're going to say, hey, do a trick for us, boy, kind of a thing.
Sure.
It has to be at the right moment, and it's kind of like if they ask you again and then a third time, it's kind of like, okay, I'll show you, as opposed to carrying something around saying, hey, let me show you something, and you're foisting your – your magic on them. They may not even want to see or just so there. I think the moment has to be right for it to be memorable for them.
Yeah. It's a balancing. It's a fine balance, but it's always a fine balance. It's like courting someone or dating someone. It's like, there's a fine balance between going from dinner and a movie to, will you marry me? I mean, it's like, it's the same with magic. I feel it's a very delicate balance that, you don't want to come across like this jerk who won't stop showing me magic tricks, even though I'm trying to leave this grocery store parking lot, there's that, but then, I have seen a lot of that, and I think when we're first in magic, I think there's a lot of excitement and a lot of like, of course everyone wants to see what I have to show them. I think as professionals, I realized that at some point I had lost the amateur's love for magic and doing magic at one point. And then I had to give my head a shake. This was several years ago, but I had to give my head a shake and realize, when I'm at the airport, why don't I just show somebody something? Because, if the moment's right, I think that's really the key. And something I learned from David Benn in Toronto, I don't think it's original to him, but the idea that, you know, the scene sets the play. I think that's what he said. I'm misquoting him completely, but the idea that where you are in the moment, whether it's the environment, the group of people, you know, basically the setting that you're in, will tell you the type of thing you need to do. So if you're in a bar and there's a stack of bar napkins, you should really probably do a trick with those bar napkins. You know, if you're at an airport and you're waiting in line to do, you know, thing, and you've got your boarding pass and you think of something that you could do with your boarding pass, then you should do something with your boarding pass. That's the, you know, as magicians, we're constantly like, wow, I got my color changing knives and I'm going to do this for every human being that, you know, it's like whether or not it's legal to even carry pocket knives, I'm going to show them anyways. And I think that taught me a lot. I mean, that mindset taught me a lot about you're in a moment, you know, how much more impact is it that, you know, you're at a banquet, for example, and you're working tables doing magic and you pick up a piece of cutlery and you do magic with it, as opposed to pulling out your deck of cards, which has nothing to do with anything, and doing magic. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah, exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So the power of that. And I guess that's
the scene sets the play, as David said, kind of a thing.
Yeah. And I think, that's the, I mean, obviously that's different than producing a show where you actually have to have, you know, create your own purpose.
Having a whole thing. Yeah. Right. But this has been marvelous. I can't believe I just looking at the clock about how quickly this hour is gone. But as we close, I always like to ask people, since the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, what is it that's your word or phrase? What is it that is your philosophy of life? What do you live by? It doesn't have to be a word. It can be a sentence.
I don't always adhere to this properly. And I'm very, but I have been trying to, my mantra in the past couple of years has just been to share the gift of magic through grace and love. That's it.
Well, I think that you have been talking about that. That's been the underlying theme of everything that you've been saying. It's not about me. It's about the experience of my audience and making sure that they are having fun. So, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Bill. This has been just a marvelous time. I appreciate the time you've shared with us and the advice and all of the stories and things you've said here as well. I know the listeners will appreciate this as well. So thanks for being my guest.
Cheers. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. It's over the Magic Word podcast. That was Bill Abbott. This is Scotty out. Wow. Good stuff there. Thank you very much, Bill. See, listeners, I told you he was going to have a lot of really good stuff to share with us. So, I hope you learned as much as I did. This was just phenomenal, just a lot of fun. Well, listen, thank you again for coming back this week and also for tuning in from week to week and hearing these episodes. And also appreciate you sharing this on your social media and also among your friends and helping to spread the word, the magic word, that is. And if you can help out a little bit further, you can actually leave a 5-star rating in the iTunes store and give us some sort of a favorable comment. If you happen to like the show, it's an easy way and a free thing that you can do that certainly helps our podcast grow. We've got thousands and thousands of subscribers, but we could always use thousands more who are committed just as you are and who enjoy magic conversation. You know, before I close here, one last thing. Over hundreds and hundreds of episodes, I always close by saying, stay well, get booked, and then I recap whatever the magic word or phrase is of our guests that week. Well, it's meaningful. I'm not just saying these words, and I truly mean it. And in these times, it's even all the more important whenever I do say stay well. And to the extent that you can get booked, and as we start to get to a position where we can do more and more shows and get out there and get booked, then I hope that and pray that what I'm saying you take to heart and know that it comes from my heart to yours. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and share the gift of magic through grace and love. This is Scotty out.